And have a quick informational meeting with an 11-minute video. Livia has been very nice. We would have set her lined up for about four different sessions. But for some reason, we've had extra stuff. It's just how that, you know, Olivia, you know, says, I think this is really a bowling video.
Oh.
She has a
from
new career.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Chair, you were pretty hot on the floor last night.
Yeah, we got two kingpins here.
There's a future for us.
if I could ever be on your team, that's where I want to be. Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Olivia Clark, the Director of Government Relations for TriMet, and I really appreciate your giving me the opportunity to show this a little video today. It's really a story of good government, I think. It started about 3 years ago in 1999. TriMet realized that the service demand was going up so rapidly, about 5% a year, that something needed to be done to look internally to try to find additional resources. And what they did was consulted with Arthur Andersen at that point. Was, you know, no cloud there, with Boeing and some other private sector interests to try to figure out what could we learn from their experience to transfer to the way TriMet does its business to try to find internal efficiencies. So that's what this story is about, and I'll just go ahead and start. It'll speak for itself.
Very good.
If we don't have any technical difficulties.
I know you can't turn up the volume, so.
I know. I think that's controlled.
It is.
On the fourth floor.
That's scary.
Yeah. It worked earlier.
Do you have any indication?
We are experiencing technical difficulties.
Machinery is rumbling.
Assistance.
TriMet, the Portland region's public transportation provider, has a national reputation as a leader in the transit industry. TriMet system, which includes some 100 bus lines and more than 40 miles of rail track, provides 90 million rides each year. TriMet's bus and MAX service is a vital transportation option for commuters, shoppers, tourists.
It worked earlier.
In this room?
Yeah, we queued it up before you got here and it was working. So.
Well, we are awaiting technical assistance, are we not, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
If you are out there, please come assist. We know there are people always watching.
Well, for the people that don't know, last night the governor sponsored a bowling fundraiser for the Oregon Food Bank, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And there was probably about 40 or 50, and there was people, legislators, other people, lobbyists. It was just really a fun evening. Raised a fair amount of money. I think it was a good icebreaker. The governor's quite an excellent bowler. They got him down on one end, and they kept him bowling. Nobody else wanted to bowl. So he bowled the last four lines for three people. It was straight and steady. So he did a good job.
Mr. Chairman, I think he had the nicest bowling shirt, too.
Yeah, his bowling shirt was classic 1950s.
Well, I should say, Mr. Chair, though, so you know, your humbleness is beyond reproach, because the chairman was by far one of the outstanding members of the lanes and has a tenacious tenacious approach to the PIN, and I would not want to be involved in without significant handicap being in a tournament with you, Senator Nelson.
It was like never picked up a ball before in my life.
Yeah, I'll never play cards with you either.
Well, evidently the governor said something this morning at the leadership meeting about people that spent their lives in bowling holes and pool alleys. Bowling alleys and pool holes. There was a sure sign of who did that as they were growing up.
Uh-huh.
So how are we doing?
They're actually going to have somebody come.
Okay. Should we try to hit it again? Should we hit it again?
Waiting for the video. It's not working. The one that Olivia's been trying to show for about a week.
Figures out.
Oh, hold on. I see something I didn't see before.
Yeah, there's. Oh, there's.
My husband always advises me to turn it off and turn it on. And then the computer will work.
Now it's your sound. Is there a sound?
You just want it all.
I'm sure we ended the sound on this one.
What do you want?
Oh, no, you're kidding.
Picture on the sound. Make up your mind.
I don't have the script, or I just, read it.
Nice
media has to.
Well, maybe you better hit the stop button again.
Hello?
Oh, wow, I think it'll be good in reverse.
Okay, shall we just do a...
Do you want to do a bill?
No, let's do a quick bill then. Okay, we'll temporarily recess the informational hearing and then open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 286. Mr. Fouts.
Senate Bill 286 specifies compensation of panels of workers' compensation board. MLAC approved. There's no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, and there is an amendment.
Very good. Lisa and Ed Johnson. Welcome, and please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lisa Trussell with Associated Oregon Industries. And we're here today and want to thank you for holding the hearing on Senate Bill 286. And we're here today in support of this bill. The Workers' Comp Board reflects the importance of employers and employees in the workers' compensation system. And the board is composed of two members with a background and understanding of labor and two members with a background and understanding of management. And then the fifth member is a public member, and that person chairs the board. And on reviewing cases, the entire board may review a case, or they can sit in panels. And for years, a panel was comprised of a member with an employee background and one with a management background, and the public member served as a tiebreaker. In the not-too-distant past, we had a situation where both of the employer reps were absent from the board. And so the board opted to continue processing cases with the panel being the two labor representatives and the public member. And while this was entirely within their authority, it created some concerns about process. Senate Bill 286 codifies the board's longstanding practice. And it puts into statute that the panel must consist of employer rep, labor rep, and then in the event of a tie, the public member. And the Dash 1 amendments allow for the public member to be on one of the, on those panels and in the situation where you would have both vacancies like we did when the employer reps were both absent. Senate Bill 286, then, in the event that we had a situation like we had in the past, then the public member and whoever, whichever party, assuming it was the employer's seats open, the labor one labor person would review the case, and then if it was tied, they'd hold it over. If they agreed, the order would go out, so they'd be able to process efficiently. And we urge your support of Senate Bill 286 with the Dash 1 amendments. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Brad Witt, Oregon AFL-CIO. I think Lisa's very adequately covered all the ground on the bill at this point. It removes the ambiguity that currently surrounds the procedural process when vacancies occur on the board. Makes perfectly good sense. It should probably be the case currently. And would also add that the Dash 1 amendments will add additional flexibility there. That all makes perfectly good sense. sense. Good bill should pass. Thank you for this opportunity.
Very good question.
Just a question, for both of you. On line 14, where it says a panel must consist of two members with different backgrounds and understandings. I'm not an attorney, as you know, but it's different backgrounds and understanding. I mean, I know you're getting to the employer and the labor representative. And is that language clear enough to you that wouldn't be misinterpreted by some future board and when either one of you might be disadvantaged by the membership?
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, we believe that's used elsewhere in the statute. 756.712-1 talks about the composition, and that talks about different backgrounds and perspectives.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzger, the same would be true. Earlier in the bill, it describes what constitutes filling those interests, and on that basis, feel comfortable that it's adequately addressed.
Great, thank you.
This went through the AMLAC board. You guys discussed the AMLAC board. That seems to be one of our standards that we're using as committee, is that these things are sent over there for discussion first.
Yes, and they have supported the concept, Bill.
You're both AMLAC members, so.
Yeah, okay. Thank you for the questions, Eva.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ed Johnson, was he supposed to be you? Yeah. Welcome, sir, and please introduce yourself.
Thank you. My name is Ed Johnson from Lincoln County, Toledo, Oregon. And I'm here, definitely would like to support this bill. I am an injured worker. I can speak from personal experience, being disabled since 1989 from a closed head injury, neck injury. I've had two spinal fusions, and we definitely need to have somebody speaks for the injured worker in public, and we need the side so at least the public has a say, because we don't have a say today. There's no say with injured workers with workman's comp today. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you, Ed. Appreciate it. I have nobody else signed up to testify, so I don't. We'll just move into work session if you're comfortable with that. Mm-hmm. We'll close the public hearing and open up a work session on Senate Bill 286. We have a -1 amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I'll move a -1 amendment to Senate Bill 286.
Okay, any discussion on the motion to put it work to move the -1 amendments? Session? Objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
I would move Senate Bill 286 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Walker has moved Senate Bill 286 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended.
And I want to thank Mr. Johnson for his perspective today.
Any discussion on the motion to move to the floor with an amendment? No objection. So ordered. I guess I can carry that. You have any great desire to carry that?
Doesn't matter.
Okay, I guess I was the one that did it.
Your bill?
It's my bill.
There you go.
I will do that. And we had a public hearing set for 563, but that was something that, following with our going through the AMLAC committee to get discussion, there evidently has not been agreement on Senate Bill 563, and so we won't be hearing that today.
That's my bill.
That's your bill. there hasn't been agreement.
Okay.
I don't know. Is that right? Were the people? Did you have people up here?
No, I think the notice went out that it had been canceled.
Okay, then we're going to hear. Okay. Is there anybody in the room that was here to testify on 563? We did have the option to have a public hearing.
Our media person is here too.
Okay. And our media person is here. How are we doing? Okay, well, okay. I guess I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill, or the work session on 286. So you want to try this, or we'll go back to the informational hearing?
All systems go.
Long-awaited premiere.
There'd be a little drama here.
Did we have any sound? Oh, no sound.
TriMet, the Portland region's public transportation provider, has a national reputation as a leader in the transit industry. TriMet system, which includes some 100 bus lines and more than 40 miles of rail track, provides 90 million rides each year. TriMet's bus and MAX service is a vital transportation option for commuters, shoppers, tourists, sports fans, and others. With a workforce of 2,600, TriMet has one of the top 25 largest payrolls in the region. TriMet is also well known for attracting hundreds of millions of dollars in federal money. In fact, the West Side MAX project was the largest public works project ever built in Oregon. All of TriMet's projects over the past two decades, East Side MAX, West Side MAX, Airport MAX, and Interstate MAX, have been built on time and under budget. Its transit service and its project management record have given TriMet a reputation as a well-run organization and resulted in high approval ratings from the public. 82% of the people who live in the Tri-County area rate TriMet's overall job performance as good to excellent. TriMet's ridership has grown every year since 1989 and is still growing. With increasing ridership coupled with projected population growth, TriMet needs to expand. Regional livability goals call for TriMet to grow service about 4% per year. But with existing resources, TriMet can only expand at about half that rate. New services require more money. But before looking to increased fares or payroll taxes, TriMet first looked inside for savings and efficiencies, because TriMet is much more than buses and trains. TriMet is mechanics, maintenance of way workers, landscapers, engineers, office workers, bus and rail operators, and many others, all working together around the clock to make sure that Portland's award-winning transit system works efficiently and serves the needs of its riders. In December of 1999, TriMet's general manager, Fred Hansen, launched a productivity improvement process that involves frontline workers in identifying better ways of doing things.
They're the ones who know their jobs best, and what we've been able to find are ways to be able to make all sorts of improvements throughout our organization.
The Productivity Improvement Process, or PIP, builds a framework for continually exploring areas within the agency where TriMet can capitalize on new technologies and make improvements that lead to increased efficiencies and better service.
We've been able to remove some of the real bottlenecks, the real frustrations that some of our frontline workers have faced. In fact, I've had employees come up to me who have said, you know, for 20 years or 25 years, they've been complaining about something, but nobody'd ever listened to them. And now, in the Productivity Improvement Program, we have been listening and making changes.
Of course, TriMet has always looked for ways to reduce costs. There have been employee suggestion programs and other initiatives aimed at saving money. But the PIP provides a new structure to bring forward good ideas.
I think it's about time to come to the people that are doing the jobs, come right down to the front lines, and ask for our input. I was thrilled.
The goals of the PIP include maximize use of existing resources to increase service, create effective employee forums to draw out new ideas, provide challenging and rewarding work with opportunities for professional growth, sustain a work environment that continually finds ways to improve systems and processes, capitalize on new technologies, and work in partnership with the union. By engaging frontline employees in identifying and solving problems, the process removes some of the day-to-day frustrations that affect the work environment.
The difference was, never in the history of TriMet has there ever been a general manager that would sit in a room and allow frontline employees to come talk to him and have them offer suggestions and ideas about how we run our business, and he would listen to them.
An early PIP effort came from rail maintenance workers, where MAX cleaners were having serious problems with new cloth seats. The seats were comfortable and attractive, but extremely difficult to clean and maintain. Employees suggested a switch to vinyl. They enlisted help from the marketing department to research what riders thought. They presented the data to upper management, and the change was implemented.
They screamed and yelled and jumped for joy. They couldn't believe it. That proposal implementation alone probably brought on board another 30% of the employees.
While each PIP is slightly different, they generally follow these steps. First, a work group identifies a process or area for improvement, and an employee team is formed. Teams may receive training in such skills as team building and holding effective meetings. In some cases, teams receive training on problem-solving techniques, such as process mapping. Next, the team sets goals and measurements. Savings may be in real cuts or improved efficiencies that allow employees to concentrate on higher priorities. New ideas are taken to the top leadership, which includes a meeting with the general manager and executive directors. By going directly to top management, bypassing chain of command, good ideas can be implemented quickly. The meetings show management's commitment to involve frontline workers in decision-making that affects them.
The main reason I think that I'm a believer in the PIP team is because I know that it has the ear of management.
I was so amazed. I just couldn't believe it. We actually had things that we had asked for or had discussed amongst ourselves for years, and boom, you know, 30 days later, here they were.
Once the new idea is approved, the improvements are implemented and evaluated. Finally, employees take what they have learned and look for further areas of improvement.
I'd say it's working because everybody sees that now we actually can kind of control our own destiny and not only improve things for our own department and working environment and for the general public, but it's an easy way for us to show the management and the company that we do have some ideas that can save a ton of money.
Bus operators brought forward an idea to save time and avoid injuries when they secure people in mobility devices. New, easier-to-use belts were installed, and the policy was reviewed and clarified. Employees saw a big difference from suggestion programs of the past.
There was one, and that's where you wrote your ideas on a piece of paper, and I don't know where it went from there. I never found one that got back to me. I know now that I have a place to go with this and with the ideas without just putting it on a piece of paper and having it, I don't know what goes on with it.
Since PIP began, dozens of new ideas have been implemented. Thousands of gallons and dollars have been saved in diesel fuel by changing idling practices and focusing on fuel economy. Landscaping practices at dozens of park and ride lots, numerous facilities, and along miles of track were changed to xeriscaping. Maintenance costs were cut, and the environment benefited from decreased need for water, fertilizers, and pesticides. Bus dispatch and rail control, which had been located in buildings several miles apart, were co-located to improve communication and shorten customer response time. Lights on Mac's cars were converted from incandescent bulbs to LED lights, saving energy and increasing life expectancy 50 times. The Information Systems Help Desk changed its hours to more quickly respond to employee computer needs. A mentorship program was developed to support the professional growth of potential internal leaders. Bus maintenance changed how and where they schedule repairs. This, along with new scheduling software and more efficient deployment of bus operators, will reduce the need for new bus purchases, saving $19 million over 5 years. When the recession hit, TriMet was positioned to handle the downturn through the PIP process. Rather than looking to cut service, TriMet looked to the PIP. As a result, TriMet was able to absorb millions of dollars in reduced tax revenue without reducing service on the street. The best part is that these reductions will produce ongoing savings. In fiscal years 01 and 02, TriMet eliminated $10 million from the budget through strategic cuts and PIP efficiencies. These cuts included $6 million in operating costs and $4 million in capital costs. And there are other benefits that are difficult to quantify, but that are equally as important.
We've seen an increase in attendance. We've seen an increase in productivity. We've seen an increase just in their morale. People are happy.
The bottom line is, PIP is working. Randy Tom, president of Bioreaction Industries, serves on a TriMet Citizen Advisory Committee. He was skeptical about the PIP at first, but has become convinced.
I, for one, am very, very sold on the idea of PIP being a viable process for TriMet, and I really hope that a lot of the other quasi-government agencies inside of the state and businesses around the state can take advantage of learning from the fact that if someone like TriMet can make this happen, then anyone can make it happen, because they've got all the challenges that any business has, and they've done very, very well in implementing it.
PIP is changing the way TriMet does business. It's becoming part of the culture.
You're always looking now because you've got somebody listening. So you, now that you've got an audience, you don't want to waste any opportunity if you can find a way to improve your workplace.
It's a real satisfying feeling knowing that if you do come up with a good idea that's going to save money, make your job smoother, whatever, that they're going to listen to it and they're going to implement it.
I think every idea, every initiative that the PIP team comes up with will ultimately benefit the public, the ridership.
The long-term goal is to integrate PIP principles and practices into the way the entire agency does business day in and day out. The PIP is making fundamental changes in how workers think.
Well, very good. Questions or discussion, comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to leave you with the impression that every idea is a good idea. You sort of get that feeling in the end. There's actually a process to evaluate every idea internal to each work division. And there, if it is a good idea, it will go up to the management committee. But we're very proud of this. We've shown the tape to people from DAS and to other committees. We think we have something that's working. And we're hoping that it really is going to be institutionalized in the organization and see further savings.
This really sounds like a good idea.
I know you're not the Transportation Committee, but I really appreciate your letting me show this, because I think it does have some transferability when it comes to both government and the private sector.
So. Yeah, Mr. Chair, and I agree with you. I think so often large employers forget about the rank and file who are out there every day and see what needs to be changed, but nobody wants to listen to them. So I love that approach. Makes it a good place to go to work every day, I would think.
Thank you.
And
thank you very much.
We're going to adopt some of these policies here.
Yeah, that's an idea. Thank you. We appreciate it, and thank you for your patience.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see. We would switch a little bit around in the order here. We'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 159. So there's a potential of a work session involved with that, and we just got the amendments. So, Mr. Dodson.
Senate Bill 159 prohibits certain conduct of payday loan lender. This requires payday lender to inform consumer complaint procedure, authorizes Director of Department of Consumer Business Services to adopt rules to regulate payday loans. There's no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, and there are -1 and -2 amendments.
Hey, good. Floyd, welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Nelson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Floyd Lanter. I'm the administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. I'm here today to request the committee's support of Senate Bill 159 as amended. The subject of Senate Bill 159 is payday lending. Payday lending is currently regulated by administrative rules. Senate Bill 159 will incorporate most of those rules into law in a manner similar to a bill relating to title loans that was enacted in the 2001 session in Senate Bill 171 in that session. I'm also providing you with a payday loans fact sheet, which supplements my testimony today. To address potential abuses, we issued administrative rules in 1999 to distinguish and govern short-term lending activities. A short-term personal loan license was established for title loan lenders and payday lenders who extend credit for 60 days or less. Oregon is one of 25 states that have established statutes and rules to govern payday lending. We actively examine payday lenders to enforce these laws and rules. We believe that this has contributed to a satisfactory level of compliance, minimize consumer misunderstanding of loan terms, and maintain the product as a short-term loan rather than as a long-term financing strategy. In fact, there's been a resounding absence of complaints for this type of activity. Senate Bill 159 is fee neutral. The bill was reviewed with the industry, which resulted in two amendments. The first acknowledges the use of electronic repayment agreements in conducting transactions. The second, drafted by the Oregon Community Financial Services Association, which advocates for payday lenders, reshapes the bill to distinguish and separate title loans from payday loans. The Dash 2 amendment eliminates a small segment of the Dash 1 amendment, and we have reviewed that impact with the sponsor of the Dash 1 amendment, and he continues to support Senate Bill 159 as amended. Oregon Community Financial Services Association advanced several well-thought-out positions in support of their amendment, and while we support their amendment, which will separate title and payday loans if approved, I would like to clarify for the record that the director does have rulemaking authority for payday loans under Section 505 of Chapter 725. I request the committee support this bill as amended and send it to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. I thank you for your time this afternoon. I would be pleased to answer any questions you might have.
And the Dash 2s, does that completely replace the Dash 1s or just a portion of it?
Chair Nelson, it replaces portions.
Portions of it. So we should still be considering Dash 1s. If they're accepted, then the Dash 2s would amend, and that would amend, Dash 2s will amend the Dash 1s.
That's correct.
Okay.
Oh.
So you got that? Questions?
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What's the average interest rate on these loans, Mr. Lanter?
Chair Nelson, Senator Walker, typically there's a fee assessed for these loans that ranges anywhere from $15 to $20 per transaction. When you calculate an annual percentage rate, as is required under the Truth in Lending Act, the APR, as it's known, can result in as high as 300 to 400%.
Follow-up?
Yes.
Mr. Lanter, besides title lending, is there any other type of lending in the state of Oregon that can charge that kind of an interest rate?
Chair Nelson, Senator Walker, for most types of the lending activity that we regulate, there is no interest rate limitation at this point in time.
I understand there's no interest rate limitation. We don't have any in statute. But is there, to your knowledge, any other lending industry in Oregon that can charge, that does charge this kind of an interest rate?
Chair Nelson, Senator Walker, to my knowledge, no. But the thing to consider is that it's a short-term lending product. So if you consider that, you're applying an annual percentage rate to that transaction. That results in that inordinately high rate.
Okay, a further question? Mr. Lanter, I was surprised to hear you say that there's a resounding absence of complaints for this activity, because the partner activity, well, I wouldn't call it partner, I guess, but the title lending industry, on the contrary, has had a number of complaints. Tell me why you think there's been no complaints regarding this industry.
Chair Nelson, Senator Walker, I think it stems from two things. One, it's basically a simplistic transaction when you look at it on the face. The terms of the transaction are on the check. And two, I hope that our examination program is working well and accounts for a lot of that, because we do spend a lot of time examining these institutions, or these lenders.
Thank you. Another question that brings up a question: how is your examination funded, by fees that these pay, or how is your process funded?
Chair Nelson, Senator Walker, we charge a fee of $60 an hour to examine payday lenders, and the examination typically runs 2 to 3 hours per exam. We look at requirements in 40-some different areas during a typical examination. We examined them twice in the first year of existence, and then depending on their condition, the frequency of the exam may extend longer than that after that.
And my final question is, I believe you did testify that these are the same sort of provisions that we passed last session in 171 with regard to car title lenders. Is that correct?
Chair Nelson, Senator Walker, that's how the bill started out. Actually, we intended it to merely mimic Senate Bill 171 of the previous session. And the industry came to us and had some very good points about the differences, if you will, between title loans, which take collateral, et cetera, and payday loans, and advocated or emphasized that they would like to see that separated. So there are a couple of provisions that have been dropped out, if you will, but we're very comfortable with the authority that we have in the rules to enforce what we need to.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, committee, for being patient.
Senator, questions? Yes, Senator Minsky.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you explain to me on the amendments that went with the staff summary, too, and I noticed it appears to be Section 6, the language that removes authorization for DCBS to adopt rules regarding payday loans. Would you explain what that is and why that would be considered good policy?
Chair Nelson, Senator Metzger, the language that is being removed there merely duplicates an existing provision. And as I mentioned earlier, when we introduced the bill, we were merely trying to mimic the bill that was introduced last time. And at that time, there was another duplication, if you will, of that rulemaking authority introduced in that bill. The industry pointed out to us that we already had that authority, and it would be redundant to put it in there twice. So
what you're saying is, then in the staff summary, Mr. Chair, that point would not be accurate. That it removes your authorization to adopt rules. What you're saying is that it removes duplicative language about authorization that you still have that. Is that correct?
Chair Nelson, Senator Metzger, yes, that's correct.
Yeah, I think that would be important in the staff summary. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Further questions? Thank you. Appreciate it. Fred Bonetta. Well, welcome, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am Fred Bonetta. Appearing on behalf of the Oregon Community Financial Services Association, which is the active and organized part of about 400 firms that are licensed in Oregon to make these types of loans. We support the bill with the amendments that you have before you. We would urge you to adopt it, and we would be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Any questions?
Just one, Mr.
Senator
Chair.
One.
Thank you. Mr. Vanetta, on the -1 amendments, it's talking about electronic repayment agreement. Is that for use of a debit card?
Those are not amendments that we presented, and I believe they are Mr. Kosasan's amendments, and he has arrived in the room and might better answer that question for you.
We're talking about the -1s.
The -1 amendment. Are those your amendments?
Talking about electronic repayment agreement.
Mr. Chair, Richard Kosasan, Community Services Financial Association. Senator Walker, to your question, I talked to the department about these amendments, I think as early as January, and this is just simply an intent to clarify language in Section 1 of the bill. In terms of having a payday loan evidenced generally by a check or an electronic repayment agreement, some are moving towards the electronic form of transmission, and this seems to be a standard that has been discussed and used quite widely.
So, if I can understand, then I would assume that we're talking about a debit card or some other kind of charge arrangement. I mean, explain to me how that's going to work. The concern I have is that I don't want payday lenders to have access to someone's debit account and they can automatically charge it off when the client doesn't have the money in there to cover the charge.
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, it is my understanding that this comes, it's not close to any kind of debit card. This is basically a repayment agreement rather than evidenced by a check. It is an agreement for an electronic transfer at a date certain. Like, just, it would be very much akin to a check that is written 12 days in advance. It is my clear understanding this does not have anything to do with a debit card at all.
Well,
I think I would share your concern with
you. Okay. Yeah, I'm really quite confused, and maybe Mr. Lanter can explain that to me. But in a payday loan, someone writes you a post-dated check, normally. Not you personally, but writes the business a post-dated check. Then they deposit, the business deposits that check on the date that's written on the check, and it may or may not go through depending on whether funds are in someone's checking account. So my understanding of this amendment would be that on such and such a date, an electronic transaction could be processed through the client's account. And is that what we're talking about? And this would give lenders an opportunity, an authorization to make that electronic debit?
Mr. Chair, once again, and Senator Walker, it would be a form of electronic transfer, but it would reflect current rules also in terms of your rules, specifically with respect to similar language, existing rules. A payday loan means a loan of money to borrow primarily for personal, family, or household purposes, collateralized by a check or bank draft, dated as of the date of the loan or later, in the amount of the principal of the loan plus interest and deferral charges. So this was an attempt to mirror statutorily the rule language in place.
Okay. Does the department have anything to say in contrary to that, Mr. Chair?
It's an attempt to modernize the language.
Okay.
Ms. Gustafson, there's the dash twos in some respect amend the dash ones. Do you have any problem with that?
Mr. Chair, no. We would. We understand the department is in support of the dash two amendments, and we would also be supportive of the dash two amendments.
Further questions?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Under the current rules, how many times can a payday loan be rolled over under the status quo?
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, it's my understanding it's a limit of three, and that, I believe, is pretty much of an industry standard that has been accepted, I believe, nationwide by the industry.
Follow, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
Just interesting, I'd be interested in your perspective on the payday loan fact sheet that we have with the testimony here. And it says that here in Oregon, 50% of the short-term lenders examined exceeded maximum allowable rollovers in one or more loans. 50% exceeded that three-time rollover. Could you explain to me why you think that has been the case, and if anything is being done to try and alter that? Because obviously if that's greatly increases the expense of the loan to the consumer, and that's why we have the three. That's why we have the three rollover standard. And if upon inspection, 50% of them are already over rolling those over more than that level, I find that a very high and you know, potentially alarming statistic.
That's on the third page. Have you seen where that is on these?
This page.
Mr. Chair and Senator Metzger, I just picked this up, and I'm sitting here trying to answer your question, and I'm going to defer to Mr. Vanatta because I hope he can get an answer.
I haven't seen the data. Is that the department's audit?
Yes, from the Department of DCP.
I have not seen the data on it, and Mr. Hansen, who is in the business, is in the audience, and he might join us.
Why don't we get Mr. Lanter first here?
Okay.
You can explain what this all means. Come on back up, Floyd, if you could. Please come up to the podium. This is your fact sheet. So we're trying to figure out what this is. You know where he's referring to? On the
yes, I understand. Chair Nelson, Senator Metzger, yes, this is a recap, if you will, of the results of our examination work during the past year. And as it points out, most of the problems that we have discovered during the course of our exams deal with exceeding the maximum of 3 renewals. And in each case, we insist on reimbursement to the consumers, and you'll see the reimbursement or the refund numbers there on the bottom, and that's what accounts for that $165,000 during 2002. In fact, the program manager just informed me yesterday, came in and talked. We just got the documentation on another lender involving the same issue. See if I got the numbers here. $96,000 that we got in the way of refunds for consumers because of our exam process and discovering the violations, if you will, of this requirement.
Yeah, all questions.
Sure. Mr. Lanter, I guess, and I appreciate that upon examination what you'd be able to do on that, but judging by your own statistic here, that 50% of those have been exceeded. I guess the one concern I have, and I know we've dealt with this issue the last few sessions, is that it would give the impression that at that level, that maybe this is considered almost a cost of doing business, and if we're examined and caught, we pay it back. But in the meantime, because there's so much more money involved each rollover, that it's become a standard business practice. And I guess my question would be: is the department coming up with different methodologies in order to really start mitigating that practice going forward, because that's an awfully high rate, and of course that keeps you very busy. If you have to audit and find so many ones, you would prefer to find fewer, so that your work is not as great either.
Chair Nelson, Senator Metzger, let me draw your attention to the number of exceptions noted line in that summary.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see in the year 2000 there were 840, and it tailed off to 388 in 2001, and then it jumped up a little bit in 2002. And I think part of the increase for the jump in 2002 was that we were able to examine 75% of the lenders in the state during the year, and we've increased our exam work in this area. So it is a process of regulation education, if you will, of the lenders. I don't know what the true answer is to your question. I do know that the majority of states that do allow payday lending allow for about 3 renewals.
Well, I think it would be interesting, Mr. Chair, since those have been exceeded here, and appreciate the work the department has. I think we would all be very, very interested to see your ongoing work, and whether we, next year and the following year, start to rein that in, so that the intent of the legislation is also met by those involved in this business. I think that's very important.
Questions?
Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Metzger raised a very good question, and I'd like to follow up on that. Is there any kind of a penalty assessed for continued violators of that provision? Or do you just make them pay the money back, and as Senator Metzger does, it's a cost of doing business?
Chair Nelson, Senator Walker, I'm not aware that we have executed a penalty or action against a payday lender at this point. The regulatory consequence, if you will, is increased examinations. And, of course, if we run into problems in a payday lender, we're going to examine them more frequently to make sure they are meeting the requirements of the law.
If I might, Mr. Chair, that's not a really big deal. It's $60 an hour for your services. Of course, nobody wants them looking in their books all the time, but it's just not a very big monetary hit for someone who consistently violates the spirit of the rules, and if we pass this bill, the spirit of the law.
Chair Nelson, Senator Walker, I agree. I think I point out here in the handout that we do, if I haven't, I'll mention to you, we do have a rating system that drives our examination process. And if we were to see a payday lender come back through on a repeat exam with a rating of 3 or lower, we go 1 through 4, 1 being the best, 4 being the worst, at that point then we would be taking more severe regulatory action against them. And without reviewing the statutes, I'm not sure exactly what the full brunt of our force could be. But certainly, if we were to go back in on an exam and see that the practice had not been cleaned up, then it's incumbent upon us to step up the enforcement action.
Well, that might be.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, $165,000 worth of penalties were assessed. That wasn't money to the department, but money back to the consumer in refunds, if I understand it, and that gets people's attention.
Well, Mr. Chair, but Mr. Vanetta, that was just money that rightfully belonged to the consumer because they were given more than 3 rollovers. That wasn't really a penalty. That was money that the consumer overpaid. Isn't that correct?
That's correct. That's correct. Okay, I stand corrected. Yeah.
Thank you.
One of the things, there's a demand for this type of market, though. I mean, would you talk about that a little bit?
Chair Nelson, yes. I brought a few notes with me. I anticipated something like that to come up. There's no denying that there's a large and growing demand for this consumer credit product, if you will. And there's a network of companies willing to support that demand. It's fairly highly concentrated. There's 4 or 5 companies that control about 50% of this business in the U.S. And it is fair to say, has been pointed out by different members of the committee, that the business, if you will, is significantly enhanced by the successful conversion of an occasional borrower to a chronic borrower through the rollover process. The total demand, I've read a number of studies. I'll cite AARP. They indicate that by 2004 there will be 80 to 100 million transactions, with approximately 15% of U.S. households becoming customers. If you take the lower, if you say each of those transactions was just $100, the average in the nation is $300. But if you say each of those is $100, that's $8 billion, which would result in $1.2 billion in fees for the payday lenders. The total market right now could be anywhere between $8 billion if you say each transaction is $100, and if it's larger, it could go, I've seen some estimates, as much as $45 billion in gross product a year. So it's huge.
Yeah. You charge $60 an hour for your examination fees of these folks?
Yes, that's correct.
How long, what would be an average examination?
Chair Nelson, the average exam runs 2 to 3 hours, sometimes 4.
Further questions?
Yeah, I did have a question.
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Either of you gentlemen could answer this question, but what would be the consequence of not passing this bill?
Chair Nelson, Senator Walker, from my perspective, it doesn't change anything. We still have, I feel we still have the regulations in the rules that we will continue to enforce. We're attempting to move it into statute to solidify it.
Either of you gentlemen have a response?
We don't believe there'd be any consequence to not passing the legislation. It is our understanding that the reason this bill was here was that when 171 was passed last session, it, because of the relating clause, applied only to title loans, and there was a request by one or more legislators last session pass the same kind of a measure for payday loans next session, and and prior folks who are no longer with who've retired from DCBS sent something to legislative counsel, and 159 showed up and not and it crunched payday loans and title loans into the same sections, which didn't function very well. Our first reaction was, why do we need a bill at all? Well, we need a bill because of some commitment that was made last session. And we understand that when you make commitments, you go forward with them. So, okay, let's make the bill work. So that's the reason the bill is here and is in the format it's in a system that we believe it works. We don't believe it changes things.
Senator Metzger?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a comment, and I'll ask Mr. Lynch for your response to it. I think, and I think your audit evaluation information is very valuable here, I think, in getting to some of the questions we just had. I think your bullet point, where it points out that flipping loans dramatically increases the lender's return on assets compared to other credit services. And I thought one thing I thought was really dramatic in this comment, and based on your research here, you know, if you take, for example, Chase Financial Services, you know, needs $100 million to make $21 million. You know, a payday lender, $100 million, will make them $600 million. I mean, there's not, you know, 21 cents for a dollar as opposed to $6 per one on the flipping of that is pretty remarkable. And I understand, too, actually, after looking over this for a number of years, I've been surprised at it, but come to accept the fact that there are a lot of consumers that want this service, and I understand that. And I think that's I'm much more amenable to it now than I was a few years ago because, for whatever reason, people want to use the service. However, based on your research and how we're going, I think Mr. Van Atta pointed out that, you know, putting this in statute doesn't necessarily change, you know, anything, because that's what we're doing now. But that also gives me some pause for concern because some of the things that we're doing now, we're not actually following through with the intent of the rule. Now I'm thinking specifically on flipping of these loans. And I think I would be inclined, Mr. Chair, to, you know, maybe have us consider where the Director of Financial Services for DCBS might have at least a little bigger hammer for repeat violators of the whether it's a rule or whether it's statute. Because obviously there is a significant payoff here, and if someone is a repeat violator of the consumer protection, then maybe there should be a penalty besides just paying back, you know, what was caught to protect both consumers and legitimate payday lenders who are following not only the spirit but the letter of the law. And I'd be curious as to your response as to if we were to amend the bill and provide, you know, some reasonable, you know, hammer for the department for repeat offenders based on your examination, what your intent to and reaction to that would be.
Chair Nelson, Senator Metzger, yes, if the legislature wants to enact that public policy, we're going to enforce that. You know, that's my understanding of the role of a regulator. I'm in the middle here. I'm neutral, but obviously we're going to enforce whatever the legislature decides is appropriate.
Well, if I can be more specific then, is that a tool you think would be valuable in conducting the purview of your office?
Chair Nelson, Senator Metzger, yes, I think it would be comparable to the authority that we have for banks or for credit unions, which have deposit insurance. We have cease and desist powers. We have the ability to level civil money penalties for, you know, violations of law, similar to that. So, yes, I would say.
Mr. Chair.
You indicated in your predecessor, in the year 2001, you had 840 exceptions. You've cut that down to about almost 400 in these education programs. Do you see any improvement, any further steps that are going along that direction? Do you have a target? You've got to cut that down to 200 or something of that nature, 150?
Chair Nelson, yes, we're attempting to cut it down, but as you see by the number of new licenses, there are a lot of people getting into this business, and so there again, that's a process. You know, we examine them twice. We try to examine them twice during the first year to make sure they're fully familiar with the requirement. But obviously, that's our goal, is to make sure that this short-term credit product, if you will, doesn't morph into a long-term credit product, because that's not what it's designed to be. Mm-hmm. When it does turn into a long-term credit product, as Senator Metzger pointed out, that the business plan for these things is pretty phenomenal, and they do generate a lot of money. And I think that's why you see them turning up like almost like McDonald's, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I read one study that talked about California has 2,000 payday lenders, more than the combined Burger Kings and McDonald's in the state. But now there's money in it. You go where the money
is. And there's a demand, isn't it? That's the other part. There's a demand.
Yes.
Further questions?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with you. I've seen them in ship and check locations where you can go and mail your packages and also get yourself a payday loan while you're in there to cover the shipping, I suppose. But I want to ask you this question because I know you regulate the title loans, too. Do you have as high of a violation rate on title loans as you do on payday loans for the three rollovers? Actually, I think title lenders have six rollovers.
Six. Yeah.
They're a little cushier.
Chair Nelson, Senator Walker, Dale tells me they're about the same. So, and he did pass me a note here that we, in our statutes, do have cease and desist powers. So if we run into a situation where we go in on an exam and the rating is not improving and we feel that management is not taking the appropriate corrective action, then we would be able to take that type of action against them and fine them.
And fine them also?
Yes.
So you already have that authority?
We have that authority. Dale just pointed that out to me. We haven't exercised that authority to this point. This is a relatively new industry.
Mm-hmm.
I think before 94 it didn't exist, and it's just kind of exploding, if you will.
Let's ask a question then.
Sure.
Based on that information then, is it your judgment based, again, this is new and you're trying to get information and you have a growing industry that you're trying to get a handle on, but based on your own statistics, do you believe that the authorities, and you say already are invested in your office, might want to look at exercising those perhaps a little bit more aggressively in the future if this trend doesn't change?
Chair Nelson, Senator Metzger, yes, I would agree. I am aware of the public perception of this industry. My work is largely driven, again, by the examination process. And before we came over, I anticipated a little bit of this line of questioning, and I had the program manager pull the current ratings for the payday lenders in the state, and we have 72% of them rated 1 or 2, which would be good or satisfactory. We have 39 of them rated a 3. That's 23% of the total. Those are institutions or payday lenders where we would be accelerating our exam process to make sure they're following up on our recommendations. And then we have 9 currently, or 5%, that are rated a 4. Now, those are the ones, if that's a repeat 4 particularly, where we should be exercising this authority.
Do you know the size of your fining ability? You've never used it, but...
Chair Nelson, 5,000.
5,000.
And, Mr. Chair, could I ask you to cite the statute for which you can find them, the statute under which you can find them?
Chair Nelson, Senator Walker, it's within Chapter 725.
Further questions? Thank you, gentlemen. We appreciate it. Ed Johnson. Welcome again. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good afternoon. My name is Ed Johnson from Toledo, Oregon. I have no grievances with the bill per se, but I do have a couple questions dealing like electronic transfers that concern me. With that part, in my opinion, and I'm not an expert in this field, but my opinion would make it so payday lenders could go into people's bank accounts if they do a deposit and withdraw the money then, when they're before they could get over to pay their debt. Personally, I would never use one of these lending agencies. I'd much rather go to a pawn shop because the rates are a lot cheaper. But the reason why we have such a need is because of our devastation of our economy and people are trying to pay bills. And my other perspective is let's the guy working at the auto shop or a single mother with two kids trying to balance things out. She get herself in deeper financial trouble by going to one of these agencies, but it's puts in her check that she gets from, say, child support or something like that, and she's trying to make sure the kids got diapers and stuff, and the agency has access to electronically access the account before she gets diapers for the kids, and the money's taken out before she get over there to pay her bill, and, you know, possible some electronic screw-ups. That would, I can see how that could devastate the family or really put a single mother or family in deeper jeopardy. So, I mean, if it doesn't change anything in laws we need now, then there's no point of it. And I'm concerned with giving more rights of administrative rules out. We give too much of that out, and we need to be protecting that because administrative rules technically are not laws. They're administrative rules. And we're allowing administrative rules when our state is laws, and that's already horrifying enough as what's going on. That's all I have to say on that. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you. Keith. Is it Bask? Keith Bask?
Basket.
Okay. Excuse me, I didn't catch that last T there. Welcome, sir, and please introduce yourself.
Keith Basket, President of McKenzie Financial.
So you can sit down.
Okay.
Speak into the...
I think we've already covered some of the things that I wanted to discuss. I want to thank Senator Walker for the free advertisement on one of my DBAs called Ship and Check. Going over this this bill, instead of going it piece by piece, I just wanted to make a quick comment about us being the payday loan industry grouped with the title loan industry. I'm trying to ask the question, why are we pushing the payday loans into an industry that I don't think matches? I think they're two totally different separate entities, and you're putting them together. And so I just wanted to find out why. That was my biggest question.
Mr. Chair, I can respond to you. The amendments take you out of that. That's the desire.
When the DCBS was up here discussing it, you asked them and said, why are we doing this, or do you think what would happen if we didn't pass this issue?
Mm-hmm.
And they said there really wasn't any great consequence. And then you asked them, let me look back on my notes here. What is the consequence of not paying the bill? They said there wouldn't be any direct consequences. They said this was something that there was a bill that was made from old commitments from 2 years ago. And it was that there was a bill that was 171 that was put on the title loan industry. And they felt that there should be something included with the payday loan industry, including them in this. And as I looked through this bill, I noticed there was a few references that directly relate to title loans that have nothing to do with the payday loan industry. And I'm wondering if we can either go through this or rewrite some of this and so it's more specific to the payday loan industry, or find out a way to separate the two.
Were these a change of floor? Would you like to come back up here again, and whoever is back there that you're... You know, maybe answer some of Keith's issues here, questions.
Chair Nelson, yes. Dash 2 takes care of the question that he just raised.
Mm-hmm.
And as I pointed out earlier, the bill was introduced before I arrived at at the state, and it's one of the things I inherited, but it was intended to mimic the bill that was introduced at the last session at the request of the legislature.
Keith, we've taken care of one of your concerns. What?
Which, I'm sorry, where was that at?
The dash.
Is it in here?
Dash two. You don't have a copy of
it. Oh, okay. Okay. Uh-huh, I don't have the amendments. Okay. Now I do. That answers that question. Thank you.
The amendments take care of your first issue. What do you have another
okay.
issue?
Okay. Then, maybe I should refresh on the amendments that I just received. On 725.610, I just wanted to see if I could get a clearer definition of that. I wasn't sure what they meant by a person may not act as an agent or facilitator. Are we talking about a specific person, or are we talking about a location? We were just a little confused on the wording of that.
Where is that now? Is that in the...
It's Section 3, 725.610.
Section... The person, okay, on page 2 of the original bill, is that what we're looking at? Page
right.
2, line,
three.
Line 7.
I don't have line numbers, but it's 625.610. It says a person may not act as an agent or facilitator of the purposes or for the purpose of making a title and then the addition of a payday loan without first obtaining a license under this chapter.
Okay.
So maybe they've amended that. I'm not sure.
And Chair Nelson, it is line 7. You're correct. That is existing language as it exists in the statute. And again, the attempt was made to incorporate these statutes, similar to the title loan.
Is there?
I'm not sure the initial definition or what went into that. Without going back and researching that at this point.
And it was not part of the amendments or anything. It's just the existing statute. Is that correct? I don't see
it. Our attorneys were just confused at that when they looked at it. They all kind of came up and looked at that and said, we still don't get this. We've looked at it several times. So if we can just clarify that, that would be... Or get rid of it.
Well, so it was not proposed to be... Can you remember? There must be a definition of a person someplace in this whole...
And then... 725.620, and I apologize for not having a line copy of this. This is just what was sent to me. Let's see. Section 1, 725.620, Section 1, a lender in the business of making title, and then now the addition of payday loans shall include in everything, and it talks about the complaint section being included on every loan application, or excuse me, loan disclosure statement and contract.
Chair Nelson, sure. That's been removed. That was
okay.
Done away with in our conversations with the association.
So you probably answered most of my questions, so I'll hurry.
Okay.
Let's see here.
That section was on page 2 of the bill, line 40.
Mr. Chair?
That's yes. Correct.
Could, while Mr. Baskett is going through this, could we perhaps ask Legislative Council to come in and describe for us what a person means under the law, if that's his concern?
Do you have an idea?
Yeah.
It's described already?
You know what?
Yeah, there's a legal definition of person in our statute.
I know what it is.
It's been the first section.
Yeah. Fine.
It's one of the result of all that.
Chair Nelson, the language is in the existing statute, and we thought by chance it was in the definitions in the first part of the chapter, but it's not there. So, I can't speak to it because I wasn't around when this was
right. Old stuff, it's never been defined, and so we were kind of curious about it because, if it's a person, then we're not abiding by the rule.
So what do you mean, a person here? How would you suggest?
Is the management of the person running a location one that needs to be licensed, or is it because right now it's the store. And we read this as the corporation does not need to be licensed, but the actual location does. And that's kind of how we read this, but that's not really what it says.
Chair Nelson, maybe I can... Maybe I can clarify. There is a definition in the administrative rules for person. It means a natural person or an organization, including a corporation, partnership, proprietorship, association, or cooperative.
new manager.
Okay, perfect.
Okay.
Does that satisfy this question? Mr. Chair, thank you. Does that satisfy your concerns?
Yes. I just needed to hear the word organization. We didn't find that, so I apologize for that. In section 725.615.2, where it talks about conduct a title and now a payday loan business where liquor or lottery tickets are sold or where gambling devices are located. Is that still in there?
Chair Nelson, yes, that remains in the current bill as proposed.
I guess if it was to continue as is, my request would be that it's clearly defined because we may be going in a chain of grocery stores and they sell lottery tickets right next door to us in the same store.
So what that section does is making these loans, you cannot do it if you're where liquor lottery. But you're asking to change that?
Yeah, because all the grocery stores sell lottery tickets. And I'd be in their building. I'd be on their location, in their premise.
So I think that some of the committee members would have a serious problem with trying to make that change. So.
Okay.
That's nice.
What's that?
Nice try.
Well, I just think banks are in there. All right, we're a financial institution as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, some people have a little different view, as you probably could tell from the questioning. So, okay, further issues.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Um, 725-605. Oh, I take that back. We've removed that. So actually that's answered three of my questions. So.
Okay, good.
That covers most of mine. And then can I just request or ask Ms. Sarah Walker if I can meet with her sometime.
Sure.
I've asked and called you many times over the past and never had the chance to actually get a return call so we can sit down and discuss some of these issues. I'm a constituent of yours and live near you and never had a chance to talk to you.
All right.
So I think that maybe we can clarify some of these issues and maybe get some headway if we had a chance to go over them a little more closely.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Baskin, my door is always open, so just call my office and make an appointment. And you can instruct my staff that a half an hour appointment would be appropriate. I only give those out sparingly.
I'd like to invite all of you to take a tour of any of our locations.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for coming up and testifying. I appreciate it very much. Any further questions?
Chair Nelson, if I could correct the record here. The cease and desist authority that was asked earlier can be found under 725-400, and we do have the authority there. However, the penalty that is available to us under 910 of that chapter is only $2,500. It's not $5,000.
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay. We have no further folks testifying. This is potentially scheduled for a work session. How's the committee feeling about all this?
I could chew on it a little bit longer, Chair.
Okay.
See if there's maybe some ways we might refine it.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger raised a very good question about penalties, and the department has not exercise those at this point, and I'm not going to fault the department because this is all very new, and as you could tell from my questions, I really detest the short-term lending industry.
No.
Yes, you couldn't tell, could you? I just think it takes advantage of people, and of course people will argue with me and say it does not, but it's, as Mr. Lander pointed out, it's a huge, huge industry, and they make lots of money at the expense of people. And so I really want to make sure that we craft something that's as tight as we can get it and gives the department a lot of authority to do what it needs to do. It's clear in this building I'm not going to get a ban on these institutions. And so I'm going to take half a loaf. But when I take half a loaf, I want to make sure that it's as tight as we can get it. So I agree with Senator Metzger. I need to chew on this.
I think you have a constituent that wants to.
And I have a constituent that wants to come talk to me.
Yes.
If it would please the chair, I would be happy to meet with Mr. Lanter and Mr. Van Adder, the representative of the industry, talk about maybe some of the concerns and see if there is a refinement that we sure. might add to the bill, and we could have just a few days to do that.
Okay, no problem. Anything else? We'll close the public hearing and we'll not go into a work session on 156.
159.
I
just wrote judiciary on my notes.
So. Oh, yes, that's not. Okay, open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 757. Mr. Dodd.
Senate Bill 757 modifies method of calculating permanent partial disability awards for workers' compensation injuries. No revenue impact, no fiscal statement issued at this time.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Who do we have testifying here? Thank you. Okay, John Schultz, where are you? Oh, there you are. Okay. Workers' Compensation Division. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I am John Schultz. I'm the administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, which is a part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Thank you for the opportunity today to request the committee's support of Senate Bill 757, which is sponsored by Senator Beyer, as well as at the request of the Management Labor Advisory Committee. And I will be discussing how the Management Labor Advisory Committee is proposing to restructure the method for determining the amount of compensation that an injured worker is eligible for when they qualify for permanent partial disability benefits. But if I may, for just a moment before I go to the heart of my testimony, the initial draft of Senate Bill 757 is currently being amended. At the request of the Management Labor Advisory Committee, they needed to make several policy clarifications, and there were some technical amendments that the division also recommended be made. We expect the Dash 1 draft amendments will be ready for Management Labor Advisory Committee review at their next meeting, which is going to be March 31st. After that, we should be able to return to your committee with the amended draft for your consideration. And I'm going to take a lot of the responsibility for the delay because I was out 3 days last week ill with the flu, and I think I also gave it to the Legislative Council when I was in for 2 hours. So I'm probably the main cause of the delay. Our existing law in Oregon is very much like most state systems in regard to the four major types of indemnity benefits that injured workers can receive. And I'll just cover this briefly. The four major types of indemnity are cash benefits that workers get are typically, one, wage replacement benefits, and those are known under a lot of different names. You may hear it most often referred to as time loss benefits or temporary total disability, temporary partial disability, it's also known as. Benefits number two that compensate for permanent impairment is what we're going to be talking about today, and that is to compensate workers for permanent impairment and loss of earning capacity because of their injury. The third area is benefits to compensate for workers who can't go back to work, ever. They're permanently and totally disabled. And fourth, there's fatality benefits. And, of course, that would be for the workers' beneficiaries when the workers' injuries are fatal. Oregon, like a number of other states, has two basic type of permanent partial disability benefits. Scheduled benefits, which relate to specific body extremities, arms, legs, hearing, and sight. And then the so-called unscheduled benefits, which relate to all other body parts, such as the back or mental functions. Impairment in Oregon is defined as the loss of use or function of a body part. Impairment is the threshold for the benefit here in Oregon. It's present in both scheduled and unscheduled benefits. Impairment is the only criterion, however, that's used for rating scheduled disability. Unscheduled disability is rated on loss of earning capacity, and that's based on the statutory criteria of impairment, but as modified by the worker's age, their level of education, and their post-injury level of physical adaptability as compared to their pre-injury level of physical adaptability. This can further be modified, however, if the worker returns to or does not return to regular work. And how that basically works here in Oregon is that if a worker returns to their regular work in the job that they were doing at the time they were injured, or if they refuse an offer of modified work, if they refuse an offer of regular work when their physician has released them to return to regular work, even in unscheduled disabilities, then only impairment would be the factor rated. So releases for regular work or return to regular work have an impact as well on the worker's final rating here in Oregon. The reason for this is that the policymakers decided that this provides an incentive for the employer to offer and for the worker to accept post-injury employment. Once the disability has been rated, and there is a somewhat complex benefit formula that translates that rating percentage of disability into a dollar amount for the worker. The result is, in Oregon, and this is unlike most other states, and in fact other Oregon benefit types, the permanent disability benefit is a fixed amount that does not adjust annually with, for example, the state average weekly wage. Typically, every 2 years, the Management Labor Advisory Committee comes before you and recommends an adjustment to the permanent partial disability rate. The permanent disability benefit is not reflective of the worker's wage here in Oregon, which is quite different than many other states. It pays scheduled awards at a single fixed rate, a fixed dollars per degree rate. However, it pays unscheduled awards at different rates based upon three tiers, with higher dollar awards paid for the most serious conditions. About 70% of the unscheduled awards are in the lowest tier only. At this point, you're probably wondering about the complication of this system, and I will touch on that in a moment. Relative to other states, Oregon benefits are relatively high for workers with scheduled injuries. They're relatively low for most, but not all, workers with unscheduled injuries. This distortion, when you compare Oregon to the national statistics, becomes magnified when wages are considered, making Oregon among the most generous states in providing permanent disability benefits for low-wage workers with scheduled disabilities, but we are among the least generous states for high-wage workers with unscheduled disabilities.
Question, Mr. Chair. Yes. You've changed terms on me, and so I just need to follow you. You talked about scheduled benefits and unscheduled benefits, and now you're talking about disabilities. A scheduled benefit is relative to a scheduled disability, which would be loss of an arm, a leg, your hearing's gone, you've gone blind. That's scheduled. The unscheduled are it's sort of the non-specific things that you can't really get to, like back pain. Am I sort of thinking along the same line?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, yes, exactly.
Okay. So the non-specific injuries that you... Okay. Now I've got it. Thank you. And we don't pay very well on those.
Because of the way that Oregon, the benefits are structured here in Oregon, we are among the least generous states in a comparison to what other states are paying for high-wage workers with unscheduled disabilities, yes, and especially with that higher-wage worker being considered, because other states oftentimes take the wage into account as well in their benefit structure, and we are not doing that in Oregon.
When did we, excuse me, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, may I ask a question? Did we do that in the big workers' comp change?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, no. Actually, the Oregon, the actual structure of how this works precedes my experience here in Oregon workers' compensation, which goes back to 1981. And there have been scheduled and unscheduled benefits here for many, many years. The reforms that began with the Mahonia Hall Group and then continued made changes to the amount of money that was going to be provided to injured workers for permanent partial disability. It also created the tier system for unscheduled disability benefits. But in terms of the basic structure itself, that predated the Mahonia Hall Group.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. The proposal development I wanted to touch on because I think this is important, and I'll cover this quickly. There were a number of issues that emerged concerning permanent disability benefit structures. Obviously, the complexity of the structure was becoming a problem. Secondly, the equity of the award values was questionable, and then again, how Oregon compared to the benefit generosity of other states was becoming an issue. The Management Labor Advisory Committee appointed a subcommittee of that group, they called it the PPD subcommittee, in September 2001 to begin working on this issue. The proposal that's embodied in Senate Bill 757 is a direct result of that subcommittee's work. The subcommittee agreed on several goals for evaluating what they wanted to accomplish, and I want to touch on these goals. They wanted to retain predictable objective factors for rating disability. They wanted to explore the wage-based benefit approach in order to better match compensation to lost earnings. They wanted to simplify the benefit structure. They wanted to achieve or exceed parity or at least maintain parity with benefit generosity with other states. And they wanted to continue to encourage return to work, and in fact more broadly encourage return to work. So following these goals, the committee evaluated a number of options and alternatives, and they have selected some policy options and have advised the Workers' Compensation Division to work with Legislative Council to develop the bill. The attributes of the bill, I think the most important attributes, achievements, and agreements are as follows. The proposed amendments simplify the process by eliminating the distinction between scheduled and unscheduled benefits. The amendments propose only two types of ratings, impairment only and impairment modified by age, education, and adaptability factors. Now, these are the same predictable rating factors that are currently being used, but the tiers are eliminated, and the difference between scheduled and unscheduled is now eliminated. The proposed amendments distinguish between workers who return to or refuse an appropriate offer of regular work and those who don't. Only impairment will be rated upon a return or a release to return to regular work. The proposed amendments would use the state average weekly wage to define the minimum and maximum benefit range. All workers with permanent disability would receive an impairment benefit, which would pay all workers at the same rate, and that would be based on the state average weekly wage, per their percentage of impairment. Workers who are unable to return to regular work would also receive a work disability benefit, which would be based on the impairment modified by their age, their level of education, and their adaptability, as well as the worker's earnings at the time of injury. The wage-based disability benefits would be limited to a wage range between 33 and 133% of the state average weekly wage, and these limits would adjust as the state average weekly wage adjusts. Finally, there was an agreement struck to add a sunset clause into this bill. So if the amendments aren't readopted 4 years after the effective date of the bill, the law would revert back to the present system.
How do you define, or how do you come to the state average weekly wage? Is that something that some agency creates?
Mr. Chair, correct. If I'm remembering correctly, I believe it's the Department of Employment that creates that.
Thank you.
In finishing, this bill does shift the actual distribution of the permanent partial disability awards with, I believe, higher awards will be paid to workers who cannot return to work and who also had higher incomes at the time of their injury. Now that would hopefully improve equity of benefit amounts across the system by better matching benefits to the earning loss, which is one of the specifically named goals in the statute for this benefit. The initial draft of Senate Bill 757, as I mentioned earlier, is currently being amended at the request of the Management Labor Advisory Committee. And again, after March 31st, we expect it should be ready to be returned to you for your review.
Thank you, John. This is a very complicated issue, and you explained it very well.
Thank you.
We appreciate your work. Questions?
Especially for
the guy who walked the canoe. How'd you do this with the
I had a lot of good help, Mr. Chair.
That's a good guess. Any questions here? No questions?
Not yet.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, John. I really do appreciate it. Ernest, Ernie, where are you? Welcome, please, and please introduce yourself.
Chair Nelson, members of the committee, my name is Ernie Del Mazzo. I represent Injured Workers Alliance. We're a statewide advocacy organization. Here today, and I oppose Bill 757. We have a situation in Oregon where benefits in every aspect are sorely inadequate. We discussed earlier the unscheduled and scheduled type. You'll notice in my footnotes there's a very good definition of each. And as Mr. Schultz explained, the unscheduled has been very lacking, especially since Senate Bill 1197. Those were part of the 1990 reforms. And this gap widened in between, and it widened even greater with Senate Bill 369 in 1995.
Have you seen the proposed amendments which would take away that distinction?
Well, what this does is this bill essentially creates a system that is flawed in many ways and replaces it with a likewise flawed system.
Okay.
MLAC agreed last Friday to hear testimony from SEIU 503 regarding this bill. They were going to put on a slideshow in Monday's hearing, and they were going to distinguish between what the effect this will have on low-wage workers versus high-wage, and it will be devastating. One of the problems being is that the younger, you know, our younger people are generally at that point in their careers where they're at the low level. When they receive a disability, of course, they're going to live longer. Disability is going to be with them longer. But yet, because of the way this is structured and the fact that they are receiving lower wages, in many aspects, they're going to be punished greatly because many cases of disability, you know, last a lifetime. Essentially, they were going to discuss that. The only reason I bring it up is, Mr. Schultz, the way it sounded here is that this was a done deal, but they did. MLAC did agree to discuss this issue at the hearing Monday, so we hope to be back on that. The problem with this is, like I said, it's a flawed mechanism. It replaces one with the other.
I just have to recess the public hearing and open up it as a subcommittee. Go ahead. I have to recess it as a public hearing and open it up as a subcommittee because two of our members have had other meetings. So.
Oh. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah.
Basically, on the face of this, it creates an unequal remedy for workplace injuries. What you have is one group. Both injuries are lifetime, and the injuries themselves are identical as far as the disability of the injury. But what this bill is doing is it's saying because this group returns to work, they don't receive the same benefits for the same disability as the other group. And again, this is unequal, and it really isn't fair. It isn't right. The remedy shouldn't be different when your disability is the same between these two groups. A disability is going to last a lifetime. Going back to the same employer is just one component of many. And for some reason, this bill is putting a lot of weight on those who cannot return to work. What this bill will do is, of course, it's going to benefit the high-wage person who becomes disabled and doesn't return to work. But instead of making the two systems fairer, as, you know, with the current system, what this system is doing is just making that much more unfair for the low-wage worker, especially who does return to work. And again, they're returning to work, and they have exactly the same disability, perhaps, as this other individual. I mean, we're talking about two identical disabilities. One may go to work, one may not go back. And again, that might have a factor to do with age and being able to carry on this work. There's other problems with this legislation, and it has to do with wording. The phrase regular work is used, and there's not a clear definition of this except in 656.726(4)(d), and what it says is job held at time of injury. We believe that, again, we oppose this bill, but we believe that this should be clearly defined in the statutes. The reason being is we went through various states that have using a system somewhat close to this, and what we found is in New Mexico, law seemed to, in some areas, come close to what they're trying to do here. In New Mexico law, though, it has the definitive statement that it will, workers must be returned to work at a wage equal to or greater than the worker's pre-injury wage. And that's in their statutes at 52-126. And we just can't understand why this language is missing, because the phrase regular work is just an extremely vague statement. And what it's saying is it's possible that worker could go back to that work and yet receive considerably less wages. And we feel that because that worker is already not receiving both the, not receiving the second aspect here, that he's already being punished, but at the same time, if he's returning back to work and receiving less than the wages received at time of injury, that's, let's call it a double whammy. At the same time, there is a situation in Oregon where a worker can return to modified work, and that's why John started to talk about it and then he got off subject, but I don't see anywhere where this bill discusses modified work. And there are situations, because of our vocational system, where it says you must receive 80% of your former wages, there are situations where somebody is returned to their previous job and perhaps can earn 81% of their former wages. They wouldn't qualify for vocational, but they could return at a lesser pay. Now, again, these people are not going to receive both of these aspects of this bill because they did return to work. But at the same time, they could possibly lose as much as 20% of their wages. And, you know, this is clearly unfair because the injuries are the same, the disabilities are the same. You just shouldn't treat people that much difference. We believe there'll be a great difference when these figures are added together between those who return to work and those who don't. Substantial difference. And again, this was going to be relayed in the PowerPoint presentation this Monday. But in conclusion, we just believe that workers shouldn't receive considerably less when their disabilities are very similar. Disability, it involves loss of body function. It's no less damaging when the worker can return to regular work, and they do last forever. Lifetime of expenses. Many of us cannot do those normal chores we used to. You could paint your own house, do your own roofing. When you're disabled, you have to hire someone at great expense. This will apply to both workers, those that return to work and those that don't, in many cases. Yet the compensation will vary greatly. We don't believe that these restrictions and life functions should be gauged on this single factor. Most fundamental way Senate Bill 757 is flawed because it treats workers with identical disabilities unequally. And for that reason, I ask this committee to oppose Senate Bill 757. And I thank you for the opportunity of testifying and can answer any questions you might have.
Okay, thank you, Ernie. Appreciate your coming here. If you have questions?
Yeah, just one, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dalmazzo, is there someone from the Injured Workers Alliance or some organization like that on the MWAC board? In other words, is your view represented?
Injured workers have never had a member on MLAC. The language of MLAC clearly states, and it's unfortunate, that they must be labor and management representatives. So it would be doubtful that unless the statute was changed, that an injured worker could be on there. Unfortunately, we have a situation where I can name about 3-4 people who are injured workers. To be honest with you, know a whole lot more than some of the members presently on there. But unfortunately, we're not, I guess, given the respect of being allowed to be on that that committee. And that's sad because more than anyone else, injured workers know the system inside and out. I could tell you one thing, unless you've been through it, you really, there's no way you can get into it and understand it the way we do. We've seen every aspect. Some of us have studied statutes, in my case, for 7 years.
Do you have opportunity to give input in at these MLAC meetings?
Unfortunately, sometimes it feels like we don't deserve the respect we should. I have a tendency in most of my hearings to cite case law, very relevant case law, and unfortunately I can't think of an instance where this has been researched further. And I can guarantee I've been right about a lot of things, including Smothers and Koskela.
Okay, well, you've got a Monday meeting with MLAC. If you bring some of these issues forward to MLAC on Monday for their consideration, I mean, that's the situation. We're not going to move this bill today. We're going to wait for what they decide on Monday. Will you have an opportunity to present some of your issues there?
Well, like I said, SEIU is making a presentation, and again, their presentation focuses on the difference between high pay and low paid workers in the case of disability benefits. And I don't know, beyond that, I don't know much because they're doing the PowerPoint, but I understand the concept knowing how this bill operates.
Yeah, that answered my question, Mr. Chair. And the reason I asked that is it was just so apropos that today we saw the video on TriMet and their PIP program and how they involve the workers in some of those decisions. So I just wanted to ask that question. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You know about the MLAC meeting on Monday, and try and get your message out to those folks and see where we're at with them.
Thank you, Chair Nelson, Senator.
Thank you. Appreciate you coming. Ed Johnson. Hello again. Please introduce yourself again.
Good afternoon. My name is Edward Johnston from Toledo, Oregon. And listening to the other speaker's testimony makes me question the bill of some things I wanted to endorse, and now makes me question of some things why I want to endorse it. You can sort of say I'm an expert, in my opinion, dealing with workman's comp. 1989, I was a bouncer at a bar, had my head caved in with a pipe at the Piptide Lounge in Newport, Oregon. And I was a bouncer at a bar dealing with, you know, making sure disturbances and stuff like that weren't happening in a tavern. Well, in the situation, it was 5-on-1. I won the war, but lost the battle. Depends on the way you look at it. I ended up with compressed discs in my spinal cord. I fought workman's comp for 9.5 years before I got my first surgery, before I basically was dying because the disc was cutting into my spinal cord. So I fought the system for 9.5 years, and if it wasn't for the thankful and the grace of Senator Gary George, I probably would not be alive today. It was some of his pushing for I get my first surgery. Workman's comp instead, I still had herniated disc. I was forced to go back to work. I went back to work 2001. In the kitchen I was in, didn't have rubber mats. My feet went out from underneath me. My head went in the dish bay, compressed another disc in my spinal cord. And workman's comp as well, dealing with the whole system when my injury happened, everybody knew it. And right now, I'm still got two more herniated discs in my neck, and if they compress, I'm looking at surgery or possibly dying. Basically, as I say, I'm on one banana peel to the grave. And I got to be take it light, because if I took it so seriously, I'd probably be in a wheelchair, so scared to go out the door. But, I mean, it's just so frustrating when disabled workers are the ones who go out there and do the work. When we come up injured, it's like, and I hate it when I hear the insurance company say that people want to deliberately go out and injure themselves. Because nobody wants to do that, and that's what just bothers me when I hear that. I've been on the Senate floor for the last two terms listening to testimony from the agencies or the injured worker or the insurance company saying how people deliberately injured themselves and stuff. This is, their feasible logic for it is not there.
How does that apply to the bill, though?
Dealing with the bill, dealing with the partial permanent disability. Now, I have been on, I ended up with 25% partial disability on the first one. Well, because of apparently some Oregon state law, they could take that away, which they did. They took away my finances that they were supposed to pay me back in 1993. And what gets to me is, now, what is this bill going to do with disabled workers? I mean, I ended up being forced back to go to work 98 after my first spinal fusion because of an accident at the job that bully said it was my job's fault. Why? Because they didn't have mats in the kitchen. You know, and I ended up injured myself again, and I don't know what my potential is for the rest of my life right now with the discs that are still herniated in my desk and the discs that are still herniated in my neck. What is this going to benefit the injured worker? I mean, I'm living it. This is a frustrating point. If it wasn't for family members and, because I don't get workman's comp. I'm still fighting the system. I get absolutely no help, no income, no nothing. And I'm told to starve, steal, or beg and borrow, which basically I've been doing. If it wasn't for friends and family members, I wouldn't be on the Senate floor testifying. I wouldn't be able to pay my electricity and water bill. I mean, I don't get no assistance, and this what really frustrates me, that there's supposed to be laws to protect us, and there isn't. In my opinion, there isn't. We're supposed to starve, and that's what I'm doing right now. I'm just basically on the border of losing my house.
Getting back to this bill.
So,
what are the things that bother you about this bill, particularly?
Specifically, what bothers me about, I mean, it doesn't, I guess, listening to the former speaker, I could understand some of his opinions dealing with the financial ends from, let's say, the gas station attendant to the, the football star.
We don't need to give examples.
Okay.
Get back to the bill. What are the specific examples in the bill that we need to be concerned about?
Okay. Dealing with the bill, which would have highlighted a little bit more, with a partial permit, I see we're dealing with the loss of the arms and the feet and stuff like this. Well, my point is I'm trying to understand. Now, I'm basically have lost my life since the original injury when I was 26 years old. I've lost my life primarily fighting all this stuff. Now, dealing with if you lose an arm or leg or something like that, well, all mine's been injured in the neck, where my whole life has been stopped from it. You know, and compensation, it's like, where's the compensation for those who have spinal and neck injuries and that stuff? If you lose an arm, you get compensated. I don't see nothing dealing with permanent injuries if you break your back, your neck, which technically my neck's been broken twice. And where's that come into play here when all you see is fingers, arms, and legs? I mean, when you lose your neck or your back, you can't do nothing. And it's just one of those frustrating situations, I guess, that I'm just still trying to understand, because I'm still trying to figure out a lot of this myself. I'm starting to...
When you signed up, you signed up in support of the bill.
Well, yeah, I am supportive of the bill, but after the other speaker said some of his deals of the wage, I sort of can understand it, but I think we need to have some adjustments to the bill dealing with spinal injuries and that stuff, so that way if people are going to be totally disabled, at least there's something. Okay. Because, I mean, I'm still in a frustrating situation that since I broke my neck on the last job I was at because of the job, I still don't have an income or nothing, and people like me are supposed to starve. And so I just don't, it's frustrating. It's like, what's the state doing?
Well, we've got this MLAC meeting on Monday. We can look at some of these issues. I mean, you signed up in favor of the bill. Now it sounds like you're not really in favor of the bill.
I think it needs some adjustments in it.
Okay.
I really think it needs some refine and look at
you,
some...
You would agree basically with what the previous speaker said, that should those particular specific adjustments that he...
Yeah, I would not go against it, because we need some savior for the injured workers. But it's just, it's frustrating, because right now, if they release me, go back to work, and with like Voc Rehab, the insurance company don't cover that because they pass it on to the state, you know, and it's like, what kind of job am I supposed to do this time? You know, I mean, you know, I got 208 discs, and still on one banana peel to the grave if I do fall or something like that. So it's a frustrating situation. I'm not sitting there like crying in my milk, but I'm just living a very frustrating situation.
We've got the issues out there, and, you know, we'll MLAC, and I think John will take those back and express them and see, you know, we've got some amendments out there, and, you know, we'll work this bill and see if we can't solve these problems.
Chair, what time was that meeting, Monday?
Gosh,
8:30
Okay.
Okay. Thank you very kindly.
Thank you. I appreciate it. We have no further witnesses, so we will close the public hearing. And anything else to come before the committee?
Got to go to my next committee.
We will close the public hearing and subcommittee. Thank you.